You're listening to the We Lead Well podcast, where well-being matters. This episode is brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchat.com and the Teach Well Alliance. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to the We Lead Well podcast. It is so amazing to be back. I've been so excited while I've been recording lots of interviews for the new series. I have had a lovely break, a bit longer than I was planning, but it was what I needed. And one of the most important things when you're looking after your well-being is that you know what you need and you know when you need a break. And I needed a break and I've had one. And now I am back and raring to go. So, on this episode, we have got the absolutely amazing and inspirational Diana Asagi. And I absolutely loved interviewing her. She's just so real and authentic. She speaks about leadership with honesty and truth, and she doesn't pull any punches, and she's blunt and direct, and she just says it like it is. And I just found that so refreshing. In her book, Courageous Leadership, which I would highly recommend to you, Diana says, success comes with messy bits, and mine came with the stuff I got completely wrong, as well as the stuff that went brilliantly. And that is one of the wonderful things about Diana, I think, is that she is prepared to accept that she doesn't always get it right, but when she gets it wrong, she learns from it, and she wants to teach you about that too, because she's so brave and courageous. And this allows her to be so upfront in this interview. You're going to enjoy it so much. She's an utter inspiration and hilarious as well. I had so much fun interviewing her. She says that she's a human first and a leader second. And that value of humanity comes across so powerfully in everything that Diana says. She talks about love in this interview, and you are going to love Diana. So here she is. Enjoy the interview. Diana Asagi, welcome to the We Lead Well podcast. I'm really grateful that you decided to join us.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you on this sunny morning in Bedfordshire. Not, but there we go. It's Romalinos, shall we?
It's almost summer. I keep thinking it's summer, and then I'm a bit disappointed. So can you start us off by giving us a little bit of information about what you do, how you've ended up where you've ended up, and who you are?
Oh my gosh, well, who am I? I'm a woman that's decided to live the life that she had in her mind. I think that's the way to describe it, really. And so that meant I had to do things, and I continue to do things that are difficult at the beginning, that sometimes a massive curveball, they don't go the way you want them to. But at the heart of everything that I do is that word courage. And it's not a cliche, it is the way I live, but it's the way I articulate it now. It's always been that way, but I didn't have the vocabulary to describe it before. I just thought that life was like that, you know, and everybody's life was like that, and everyone did the kind of things that I do. And then it wasn't until headship, really, when I became the head of a secondary school in North London. And it was, I can't remember who first coined the phrase a bog standard secondary school, but we were one of them. We were bog standard. We were not part of a mat, so we didn't have a big machinery behind us to guide, support, and to do all those backroom functions that schools now take for granted in a way. We did everything ourselves as a standalone bog standard secondary school in a cul-de-sac in North London, surrounded by estates and surrounded by a phenomenal community of diverse, wonderful people. But to lead a school in that context, it was a challenging urban school. And my young people, the majority of them, had challenges that were screaming no. No to you going to university. No to you fulfilling your potential. No to you having a job or a career that you deserve to have. You'll have what we give you. You will lead the life that your parents led before you. You won't even have dreams, let alone fulfill dreams. So their narrative, lots of them, not all of them by any means, but lots of them had a narrative laid down before they were born that screamed no loudly as they came out in the delivery room. And I picture it like that, because that gives me that continued drive that when you're giving birth, it's an intense moment, but that intensity is full of joy when the baby's there. And you're full of hope and joy and expectation, and you can't think of anything but wondrous, the best for your child. But there's this unspoken narrative that's, you don't hear it in the delivery, but it's right there. The narrative of no, for some young people, it starts in that delivery room, because you were born in that postcode. You were born to these parents. You were born in this circumstance. And so I was a head teacher who stood against that narrative. Because in my life, my parents stood against that narrative of our circumstance of living on a South London council estate. And father in and out of work due to many circumstances, mother holding down I don't know how many jobs, both of them very well educated, very articulate. But nevertheless, the circumstance of their skin colour in the 70s was screaming no very loudly when I was born in the 70s. And Vicky, Victoria, you look much younger than me. You look like you remember the 70s when it was a difficult time in England.
I was born in the 70s. I was born in 1976. So vague recollection.
I was five when you were born. So I understand that narrative because I lived it. I lived the pupil premium child existence in terms of poverty, in terms of your free school meal was your best meal of the day. And you look forward to school on a Monday because sometimes the weekends were quite sparse in terms of food. So I knew that narrative from personal experience. When I became a head teacher, I stood against that narrative, but that had to take courage because I'm building a school with my governors, with my teams, where we're saying arts and media is at the heart of what we do. Every child is entitled to dance in a dance studio with a sprung floor. Do you know how much that costs to build a school like that? To build a ballet bar with ballet mirrors and a sprung floor, that every child can have that. Not just a beautiful girls' school in Cheltenham, but a bog standard secondary school in Islington, North London. Every child can do art and media and dance and music and science and maths and technology. Why should there be a barrier to their dream? If their dream lies in dance, and I'm not going to be the one that says no to that dream because it must be STEM and only maths. If their dream lies in maths, then I've got to have qualified great maths teachers to teach them maths. Do you know how much that costs? When you staff your school only with specialists, every teacher has to have a degree in the subject they're teaching. So it's not PE doing a bit of maths or PE doing a bit of dance. I've got dancers teaching dance, mathematicians teaching maths. That took courage because the narrative of the school was get them through. Just get them through. Austin are coming, just get them through. Do what you have to do to get the results up. Just get the numbers right. And when you have to stand and say, I want the numbers, absolutely. I want to have academic success. In fact, I want more than numbers. I want every child to be a scholar. What do you mean every child? Do you mean these children, putting up the air quotes? Do you mean the children that are black? Somali kids, the ones that don't speak English, the ones that are disadvantaged? Yeah, all of them. Whatever they choose to be a scholar in, I want them to be a scholar. If they choose dance, go for it. Maths, go for it. But to swim in the depths of their subject, to enjoy it to the max and to the full, and to become experts in it. I want that for our young people. That costs money. Do we have money? We've got a massive deficit. I've got to clear that. That took courage. Because when you're telling staff, I've got to make redundancies, and they've been told previously, we will never have redundancies in our school, you become the Wicked Witch of the West, don't you? You're in your first year of headship and you're facing onslaught of difficulty. You're facing adversity that you've never planned for this because the MPQH doesn't teach you that. The MPQH, The way I teach is very different to the way most people get taught, because I teach the MPQH that you become a head teacher that can face onslaught, that can deal with the glory of headship, but can deal with the trench warfare that sometimes comes with it as well. And it can be like that, a war of attrition, of ideologies and of procedure and ways of doing things that have been entrenched into the community for years, serving no one but the people who, you know, who benefit from a very small part of that community. So I didn't know how to be a head, practically. I knew the ideology of it. I knew the book of it, the MPQH version of it. I had my master's, well, with my second year of degree, I had my master's, my second year of headship, I finished it off. I had done trench warfare as a deputy for 10 years. But when I became the head, I didn't understand that phrase, the buck stops with me. I thought that meant you had to be lonely and you had to take things, decisions on your own, and nobody was there for you, and you were isolated. That's what I thought that phrase meant. It doesn't mean that. You take ultimate responsibility, but you devise ways of making decisions so that it is genuinely a subject of all our parts, not just of Diana. So I learned a lot in my headship about me as a woman, about myself as an educator, myself as a leader. And I learned this, I think, you know, in answer to your question, who am I? I am human first and a leader second. I remember the importance of family, love, grace, and compassion. And I coined these seven courageous statements. That was one of them, through the headship. And I then wrote the book, Courageous Leadership. Because one thing I learned most of all was it is easy, easy to lose your humanity when you're leading in adverse circumstances. You become automated. You become such a leader that actually people can't approach you as a human, as a woman. They have to approach you as a leader. And there's this ladder is set up that people can approach you if they climb this ladder of leadership towards you. But just to come to you as a person and say, I'm hurting. My data's late because I'm actually hurting in a different area of my life. I'm stressed. That's why I've not taught a decent lesson for a month, because I'm stressed about my child at home who's sick. But if I don't come to work every day, I've already had so much absences, you're going to sack me. So the stress is overwhelming me, but I need to approach you as a human first so we can talk and engage, and not as Diana, the leader. When I learned that, I set up what I call head surgery, which is every Tuesday night without fail for 6 years I did this, 3:30 to 5:30. Anyone in the school community could come and talk to me about anything. You made a 10-minute appointment with my PA. I want a head surgery slot, please, on Tuesday the 15th. You don't tell her what it's about. She just puts you in the slots. And you come and talk to me for 10 minutes about anything you want. One-on-one, not teams, not the whole union turn up. Just me and you. Tell me what's going on. Tell me what your fears are, your hopes are, your dreams, whatever it is you want to talk to me, and it's confidential. Obviously, if you disclose something that I need to talk to someone about, you know, if you're saying to me, I feel suicidal, I've got to do something about that. But during that head surgery, I began to regain my humanity by explicitly putting aside time for my staff to engage in relationship with me. We say this so glibly. Is that a word? Glibly?
Yeah.
I'm saying this so glibly. I've got an open door policy. Most heads will say that. Most heads haven't got that because, one, they're never in their office because they're out and about, which is a good thing. Or when they're in it, the door's shut because they're in a meeting. They're doing something. So genuinely, it's not open to the NQT plus one teaching French on the third floor. But if she was the head of maths, she could come and knock on my door. But she's not. She doesn't feel empowered to do so unless I make explicit time for her or him to engage with me in relationship. So that's me. Bit loud. I can do subtlety, but I've got to really think think about it, you know, if I'm going to do it. I've got a plan to be subtle. But do I fight? I don't fight. I put my head down and I get the grunt work done. Leadership's those moments where you get glory to glory. Results day to results day, to sports day, to the day where the school played. Those are glory moments. There's a two, glory to glory. The two represents the leadership grunt work, where you just turn up every day and you just do what you have to do. And I've spent the last 20 odd years just doing that, doing what I have to do. And apparently I have to do a lot.
That's Diana, me. You are so passionate. I find it so inspirational. Where does that passion for education come from?
That's got to be from, from my childhood. You know, as I said, I grew up in a poverty circumstance, South London council estate. I shared my bedroom with my brother until I was 19. I went to university. And the only door that would allow my life to change was the door of education. My parents knew that. And also, I'm from an African background. My parents are both Nigerian. They're from the same village in Nigeria, in Benin, South Nigeria. And African culture values education highly, highly. Yeah. And to be uneducated, and I don't just mean school, you could be in the village, but you know stuff. You know how to grow your fields and your vegetables, you know how to farm, and you know. To be ignorant, I think, rather than educated, to be ignorant is an absolute disgrace in African culture. So you need to be, what's the opposite of ignorant? Educated, enlightened. And then when you're educated in terms of academia, you know, that's the top thing. So that, it was expected. Poverty or not, Diana, you're going to university. I mean, there was no, what would you like to do? That was never asked in my family. My mother chose my options when I was in year nine. You know, we went to parents and they said, well, what would you like to select? You want to do? So my mum said, well, she's doing this. She brought the list with her. And she said, this. And she can do art because that's where she can relax a bit. So my mother chose art for me because she thought, well, that's a waste of time. You could do that to relax, you know? I then became the head of an arts and media school, which is slightly ironic, right? My mother opened my results from university when they came in the post. You know, I was just hoping, please let me not have a third. Please let me not have a third, you know, because that would have represented disaster. I already flopped my A-levels. That went down like a bucket of sick, you know, flopping your A-levels. Oh, God. Those days, ring in Nigeria, you had to ring your operator and it wasn't just pick up your phone and ring. She rang everybody back home to tell that Diana's failed her A-levels, life is over in England, we're coming back. So it was that, it came from there. I had parents who knew the narrative that was set up for me was not enough they were going to allow in my life. They were not going to allow it, just not. I then had a school, my secondary school, which is Sydenham Girls in South London. And my head teacher was Miss Sakowicz. So she was the first Polish person I ever met. She was 4'9" tall and about 4 foot wide. She was like a little round ball. And she wore these long dresses, so you couldn't see her feet. So I genuinely thought when I was in year seven that she was on wheels, that she just came wheeling around the corner, because she always kind of like appeared when you were being naughty. She just wheeled herself around, she just stood there, looked at you. And you absolutely bricked it. She was 4'9" of powerhouse. You did not challenge Miss Sakowicz. And there were 1,500 girls in this secondary school in South London. So it was like a hotbed of estrogen. If a boy walked past the school, I mean, his life was in danger. We hadn't seen that, you know? So I had this school that backed girls. I mean, Miss Sakowicz set up a school that backed us. We didn't have a computer between us. So she put us in cabs to the boys' school to go and use their computers. Then the cabs brought us back again. When I say she backed us, so we had a school that backed me. I had parents that backed me. Therefore, there was no gap for me to fall between and lose. When you've got that, a school that backs the children, you know, I'm in your corner. I know you want to go and join a gang, but you're not going to because I'm in your corner. So if that means I've got to walk you home, that's exactly what I'm going to do. You know, you've got parents that back you. But if you haven't got parents that back you, we at the school will be your parents and we will back you there as well. So when you have that narrative in your life as your experience, you build that, you replicate that, but in the 21st century version for the young people in your care. So when my children will say, oh, miss, you're long, low it, man. That's how year 11s talk, right?
I have no idea what you just said.
Long means you're getting on my nerves. Why are you making me do my English revision? I want to go home and play on the PSB. But when you say it's long, it means I don't want to do it anymore. That's a year. It's very long. Very long. Keep doing it until you've finished, because you're not leaving, because I've locked the front door. There's only one way out of our school and I've locked it. So, you know, I'm radical like that. I mean, we did have safeguarding in those days, but it was a bit different. It's now, you know. So things like that, oh, we stand on the front gate, you're not leaving. I'm 6 foot tall. Try and get past me. I challenge you to get, they look at me like, nah, she'll knock me out. So go back up to maths, revise, I'll bring you a drink of orange juice in a minute. If I've got to be your parent, that's exactly what I'm going to do. When results day comes around, you understand what glory feels like. But right now, grunt work, get up there, get it done. That's where the passion comes from.
Do you apply the same with your staff? One of the things that I was talking to Julie Norman about is that I think a lot of leaders in schools don't apply the same, they don't treat adults the same way they treat children. And at the end of the day, I think everybody in your school is just a human being and they respond in exactly the same way to the way that you treat them and the way that you get work out of them. So do you treat your staff in the same way?
I put it this way, I love hard, I play hard, I work hard. If I'm in your life, and I used to tell my staff this, and at first I'm like a bit dubious, but so if I take my senior team, so I mean I'm reaching up because it's an audio podcast, I'm reaching up onto my, that's my, I'm showing you a picture of me and my deputy head curriculum, my deputy head pastoral, it's still on my, I mean, I've been out of school now for 6 years. It's still on my wall. I love them that much. We were at an ASCOL conference. If I love you, you will know I love you. Your life will change for the better because I'm in your life. I remember the importance of family, love, grace and compassion. Even if I can't stand you, I will give you grace. Grace means favor that you don't deserve. There were staff who I couldn't stand. Oh Lord. When I say I couldn't stand them, but they were talented teachers. My young people got a great deal. So whatever they needed, I would give to them. So I could get that phenomenal teaching out of them for my young people's lives to be fulfilled. So that's the way I looked at them. So if you need something, and it's in my power and gift to give it to you, I will do it, as long as it's legal, of course. So I loved hard, but I do remember times when a member of staff would get on my wick. And this member of staff, I mean, they got, oh, look, I can't even thinking about it, I feel nauseous. So at the end, I thought, you know what, I'm done with this. So I called them in and I said, listen, right from now on, I'm your employer, you're my employee. Forget the love. Forget the grace, forget the compassion. I'm done with you. You take the mic, right? You want something, put it in writing. I don't want to talk to you anymore because you've not upset me. You've taken advantage of the kindness that I've extended to you over and over and over again. Enough is enough. Oh, well, there were tears before bedtime, blah, blah, blah. Because I said to him, now you're going to realize what it is to be loved by a leader. And now you're going to see the difference between being loved by one and just being led by one. Okay, so done. I'm just going to lead you now. I'm not going to love you anymore. She went and told everybody that Miss Osagi stopped loving me. It's not fair. I want to be loved like you lot. I mean, it was ridiculous. But that's what I'm like. But in that love, I said to people, don't, what's the word? The young people say, don't get it twisted. Don't get it twisted for weakness. Don't mistake the fact that I love you, that I care for you, I care for your family, I care for you as a person first, a human first, as my teacher after that. Don't get that twisted with weakness, because love is, it can be very tough. It can be very sharp. Love can be quite demanding. So don't think that I will not hold you to account. Don't get it twisted. I will. As rigorously as your job title demands it. So if you have a title that says head of something, I expect you to bring me results and performance that indicates that you are head of something. So don't mistake my love for weakness. And that's what that person did, which is why I cut the love off, right?
It's so interesting that you talk about this, because I've been involved in discussions on Twitter about whether it's acceptable to tell children and tell staff that you love them. But you bring like a different perspective on that, because I think that, yes, when you say you love the children or you love the staff, you're right. People see it in this like really cuddly, oh, well, let's be all fluffy and nice and all love each other. I used to say to, I remember when I worked a school in Bolton, we really improved the results and we cut the gap between boys and girls massively. And the local authority or the school improvement partner asked to speak to me about it. And she said, what do you do? And I said, we love them. We love the boys. And often that is tough love. Like when you love your children, you don't just let them get away with anything, do you? You want the best. I think the idea of love, like you're saying, it sounds to me like it's about wanting the best for people and from people, isn't it? And
it's love is, you could, if we think that schools basically are a hotbed of relationships, when you've got more than three people in a room, you've got a relationship set up, you've got a dynamic set up. If you've got 750 teenagers, you've just got relationships everywhere. Then you've got 100 staff. Then every teenager's got parents. You've got thousands of relationships all over the place. So how can you not have love? Because what is at the heart of relationships? Love, trust, respect, communication. But take away love from that, you rip the heart of relationships out. If I want the best from Vicky, the best from Diana, the best from Sarah, I've got to love her. You only thrive when you're loved.
Before we find out more from Diana about how love can help your staff and pupils thrive, I just want to talk to you a little bit about our partner, headteacherchat.com. Headteacherchat discusses lots of topics, from how to support pupils with learning, how to support parents, and the many issues that come with leading a school. The aim of Headteacherchat is to support headteachers and school leaders who are in a challenging and often lonely role. They do this by offering lots of information for schools to tap into. For example, they have lots of fantastic education companies on their database for leaders to discover, as well as leadership templates to download. They've written product reviews for leaders who are looking for products for their school. And this year, they've even launched the very first school leader planner, especially designed to help leaders to be productive and organised. If you'd like to hear more about Headteacherchat, you can find them on their website at www.headteacherchat.com. Headteacherchat. It's what head teachers are talking about. Now let's get back to the interview.
Who thrives in the absence of love? Nobody ever. You do. You might do well. You might achieve. But you don't thrive when you're not loved. So why would you not? It doesn't make any sense.
I think...
You should not love your staff if you want them to do the best. It doesn't make any sense.
I've been reading... I learned quite a lot about attachment theory. And something that I've been reading lately talks about attachment in adulthood as well, and how people need attachments. And I think because we spend so much of our lives in work, it's really important that we have those relationships, isn't it? And what I really like about what you're saying is that I think a lot of senior leaders, I think it's great that you're just prepared to say, some people who worked for me, I just really got on my nerves, and I really, I'm like totally frustrating when people who have the potential to be brilliant are not fulfilling it and trying to take advantage or whatever. But what really inspires me is your ability to talk about it in that way and actually have that conversation with someone, and it come from a place of, well, I suppose in that last example you used, it was, I'm taking the love away now because it's not being reciprocated. But love is about also being able to have those courageous conversations, isn't it? And being brave enough to say, I love you, therefore I'm telling you this.
Yeah, absolutely. It is that. And I love you, I respect you, I trust you, I want you, but don't take the mick. You know, it's not that kind of love where you can stamp all over it. You know, it's not that, you know, you've got love between a mother and a child, and sometimes the child will literally just, you know, trample all over the mother's emotions. But a mother can't stop loving the child because it's the child, what are you going to do? It's not that kind of love. So I call it professional love. It's within the professional context. It's valuable because we do. Sometimes I'll be with my senior team 14 hours in one day. And we're back again, you know, 7 o'clock next morning because we've got a breakfast meeting or whatever. We'll spend our lives together. How can you do that without love? You can't. Well, you can, but it's not fulfilling. It's not rich. And for the job that we had to do, I had to have my staff who were fulfilled, felt safe, psychologically safe, felt rich. That took a while. Don't get me wrong. I wasn't perfect. It sounds idyllic now. I was not perfect. I made mistake after mistake, got it wrong, start again, still got it wrong. What could I do? But I decided that I could only be myself. So we hear about authentic leadership, and, you know, it's become a big movement now, but I can only be myself. This is what I'm like. I love. I love. I play hard. I love hard. I work hard. When I'm resting, don't ring me. I'm resting. I do everything to that kind of extent. And so if I'm going to be a good head teacher, let's just start with good. You know, that'll do. If I'm going to be a good head teacher, I might as well be the Diana version rather than this sort of made up version of what a leader should be like. I'm just going to be me and see if that works. If it doesn't work, then we'll try something else or try being someone else. But that's what I'm like. And so I always say to people, you know, you go to look for your headships or whatever, make sure you like the school, go and look round. I'm looking, if I'm going to a school now, for example, I'd be looking for very different things to what most other people are looking for. You know, can I love these people that are here? Can I give myself to them? Can I be vulnerable in their hands? Because, you know, when you tell people your truth, when you tell people where you're from, I remember when I said to, you know, I'm from a state in South London. I went to a polytechnic back in the day. It became a uni later on, but, you know, I didn't, you know, that's my story. And there was a couple of people tried to use it against me that, oh, well, you know, what would she know? She only went to a polytechnic and that kind of thing. So, you know, you begin to hear these whispers of people using your truth and trying to be, make you vulnerable in their hands. And I had him up, I had him in my office, you know, and I just said to him, I'm just going to ask you two questions. How much do you earn? And he told me, how much do you think I earn? He had a guess. I said, add on 20, now add on 5. That's what I earn. Where did you go to university? Durham. Where did I go? Wolverhampton Polytechnic. Now walk out my office, you know? So just think about that, right? I went to Polytech and I earn twice what you earn plus 20. And I'm how old? And I said, now how old am I? How old are you? Right. So think on, mate. Next time you want to put someone down because of where they went to university. You know? So I love you, but don't take the mic.
What I'm really interested in is, and the listeners will know this because I bang on about it all the time, is about women in leadership. And I think it's really important that we give women opportunities and we build them up and we build their confidence, because a lot of women out there, a lot of teachers, a lot of heads of department, they do themselves down, and then they let negative thought patterns control them, and they don't apply for opportunities, and they hold themselves back sometimes. Mm. But what I find, and I'm exactly the same, Diana, I made a decision at some point, I didn't want to be a head teacher. I could have been a head teacher, and I know I could have been a good, like you said, I could have been a good head teacher. I chose not to do it, and I chose to take a different route because I want to help women in leadership. But what worries me when I speak to a lot of the women that I speak to, in what I'm doing now is that they say, yeah, I don't want to be a head teacher. And it makes me feel really sad because women make brilliant head teachers. And I'm not saying there aren't brilliant male head teachers out there. Don't get me wrong, there are. There are some amazing male head teachers. I've spoken to lots of them and I've worked with some of them. But how can we support more women into headship? How can we make more women think that is the role for me? That's what I want to do. What is it that's stopping women from making that decision? And how can we promote it more?
I think it's if I say this, it's nothing to do with qualifications. It's nothing to do with experience or have you been deputy for pastoral or curriculum or timetabling. It's nothing to do with any of that. It's all to do with internal narrative, completely. It's what women say to themselves internally, every day, all day. It's actually not even to do with headship. It's about internal narrative as a female. And I speak on this because I call it one of the six golden nuggets of leadership, of female leadership. We internalize the workplace toxicity. So if something's going on that's wrong or difficult or malicious or toxic, we internalize that into ourselves as a person, and we take on the emotion of the workplace as a woman, not as a leader. We internalize it quite deeply. One, stop doing that. There's a way to stop doing it, but we haven't got time to talk about it right now. But then two, we add on to that, we have an internal narrative that works against us. Oh, my bum looks big in that. Oh, I could never wear makeup. Oh, I can't leave the house without makeup. Oh, I can't have short hair. Oh, I could never wear long hair. I've got big ears. I mean, it's constant against ourselves. I'm not even talking headship. I'm just talking about being a female. My husband has never, ever said to himself, does my bum look big in this? Never. And even if it does, he don't care. He'll just say, it looks big, job on. You know, he doesn't have that narrative that takes him down. He's a bit of an alpha male. He thinks he looks like the bee's knees. He don't, but he really does think that. He's 55. He looks good, he does. He looks like he's 35, gets on my nerves. But he'll preen in the mirror, flab everywhere, a bit of muscle there, but he thinks he looks like he was 21 again. I will walk with my towel around because I am not preening, no mirror, because my belly sticks out. You must be joking. Do you know what I mean? But we have this narrative inside our heads that pulls us down as a person on the planet. Forget headship. Yeah. Once you grab a hold of your internal narrative, then you've got an opportunity, a chance to grab a hold of potential like headship, like senior leadership. Because that narrative will let you get to middle leadership without too much difficulty. You step out and go for an assistant headship. Whoa, then if you can do that, will you be accepted? Or do you know enough? You start asking yourself stupid questions, right? My husband has never asked himself, do I know enough? He's never asked that question to himself. I've asked him. He goes, why would I say that? We look at a job description or person spec. If we can't do three things on it, we won't apply. Three. I could do 97%, but 3% I can't do. My internal narrative says, oh no, you haven't got the experience they're looking for. My husband, if he can do three things on it, I'm going for that job. Three things. What about the rest of it? I'll learn it on the job. That's the attitude. We don't have that. I don't know why. It's not naturally built in. It's just men are from Mars, women are from Venus, whatever. If you don't grab a hold of your internal narrative and shape it and nurture it and discipline it, it will limit you forever. It will limit how you think, oh, am I a good mother? My child swore. Maybe it's me. Maybe I did it. It will limit you as a mother. Am I a good daughter? Am I a good aunt? It will limit every area of your life. Forget headship. You've limited yourself as a person. Headship is out of your reach because your mind won't allow you to even go there. Headship is difficult. Yeah, it is. So is giving birth.
Yeah. I'll vouch for that.
So is running a house. So is loving a husband that gets on your nerves. Lots of things are difficult. You can do difficult things.
And isn't it interesting, as women, we do all those difficult things. We are spinning all of those plates, aren't we?
All the time. But we think, oh, I can't do that plate. Why not?
When I'm coaching women, I will say, also, what is it that, so if I'm talking to, I don't know, let's call her Jane, and say, what is it about negative Jane that always wins out over positive Jane? Because people will say to you, I know I'm good. I do know I'm good. But there's always a but that comes with it. I do know I'm good, but I'm a bit worried about this, I'm a bit worried about that. And I'm like, what is it, this negative Jane, always, like, you've got these two personalities, yeah, two people within you, and yeah, one always seems to win out over the other. How can you really convince this other element of yourself?
That's it. Because you know what it is? That element, that negative Jane, serves a purpose. It keeps you safe. It keeps you secure. And women, we're always looking for security. It's part of our makeup. You know, we want security relationships. We want security in the home. We want security financially. You know, we're always looking for security. We're always looking for comfort. And negative Jane keeps you safe. It stops you from trying something. I mean, I've got people, I coach women, they won't even try a chili pepper, for goodness sake. Oh, it's a bit spicy. I don't do spicy. I'll just have salt. What's wrong with you? What's the worst that can happen? There's water there if it goes a bit wrong. But their internal narrative won't even let them try a different food. So headship is out of the question. Do you see why it's out of the question? They won't even go to a restaurant and try the spaghetti carbonara because they always have a pizza. Just try something else. Oh, no. Someone I knew once had spaghetti carbonara and they died, so I'm not going to do it. You know? Oh, I know. I've seen headship. It looks horrible. I'm not going to do that. I'll stay here where it's safe, where I'm secure. And we're at fault as well. We, as in the education profession, we've painted a picture of headship as this lonely, difficult, awful experience.
Yeah.
That's not the entirety of headship. It's lonely if you choose to work alone. That's up to you. I would say don't make that choice. But if you choose to isolate yourself, then of course you're going to be lonely. But if you choose to network, have a coach, have peers, work with your teams, work with your teams, work through your teams, there are times when you work alone. But that's a choice. There are things that are difficult, but you have to solve it on your own. You've got the local authority to help you. You've got the union to help you. You've got your MAT to help you. You've got other leaders to help you. Why work alone? That's a choice. But we've painted this weird picture of headship.
Yeah.
Normally, a white male in his 50s in headship. That's not the sum total of school leadership in this country, by any means. But a woman looking at that would say, that's not for me. No, that model isn't for you, but you are for you. You as a head will be phenomenal. You trying to be Drew Provey will be awful. You trying to be Diana Osagie will be a disaster. But you being you, now we're talking. But there's that internal narrative work we've got to do first. We've got to get past the, does my bum look big in this, that you've got in your head, that you won't even leave the house unless you've got your lippy on. Because you're, why? If you got it, you got it. But I know women who would rather be late and go back home because they forgot their earrings.
Yeah.
So you're not ready. You're not ready to lead like that. If that's how your mind works, you're not ready to lead.
The listeners of the show are not confined to females. There are lots of men who listen. So how, and I know this is not, it's not purely a woman thing. There are men out there who do, you know, have negative thought patterns, suffer from imposter syndrome. I think it's just probably not quite as pervasive as it is for women. But how can men support more women into leadership positions and into headships?
You know, when you say, I'll go back to that statement about being human first, leader second.
Yeah.
If a man wants to get the best out of all his community, women leaders, male leaders, and so on, then you've got to do that first. If you're human first, it means that you listen, that you love, that you care, that you nurture, that you cherish. Those don't sound like leadership qualities, do they? Loving, nurturing, caring, and cherish.
Yeah.
But they are central to leadership. But if I say to a man, be loving, be nurturing, be caring, and cherish, I'm like, what, am I going to run the school by running a creche? You know? So I'm asking a man to bring to the fore of his leadership that which seems like an antithesis to him. But if he does that, then women can relate more to that kind of leadership. When you relate more to that leadership, I will buy into your vision with greater purpose and a renewed passion. I will thrive because I am loved. When I'm thriving and you see how good I'm doing, promote me, encourage me, push me forward. If that means I have to leave your community, then so be it. Promote me into my greatness. You're the head. There's only one head job. Get me to headship. Let the profession benefit from me being a head that's come from underneath your tutelage. That's a man who's an ally to female leadership. When you operate like that, it's not a deficit that people are leaving. It's a benefit. People will be queuing up to come into your organization because you get known for being like that. That's a long-term commitment and calling.
And that's the thing. These are not things that happen overnight, are they? You have to put a lot of time and work and show a huge amount of commitment to this, don't you?
Yeah, but you recognize the benefits of this. Just imagine in your organization, your leaders are thriving, male, female, they're thriving. Under them, the teachers are thriving at the top of their game, healthy and committed. Well, who doesn't want that? If you think about it, if you don't want that, why are you here? You don't want your teams to be healthy and committed and thriving? Why would you not lead in a way that leads to that? You'd be cutting off your own strategic advantage, which doesn't make any sense. It doesn't. And the one thing that you're not is silly. You are a sensible person, if anything at all. So therefore, do what makes sense to bring about that thriving, healthy community. So guess what? Do your young people benefit? I think they might. If Mrs. X is thriving as head of home economics, and Mrs. X is thriving as head of physics, and Mr. X is thriving as head of DT, hello? Why would you not lead that way? Because it's never been done before? Because you're a man? Because you think you wonder what people might think about you? Because that's not the tradition of this school? That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any business sense, strategic sense, community sense, moral sense. It doesn't. So why would you carry on doing that? That to me is silly. And I will step away from you. If you're going to be silly, well, I'm not going to involve myself with you. So being a male, being an ally to female leadership, it brings you as the man into your greatness also.
Brilliant.
It does. I love that. Look at Obama, he promoting Michelle.
Oh, yeah.
cherishing her, pushing her forward, brought him into his greatness. He would never, never in a million years been president of the United States had he not promoted and pushed and encouraged and supported his wife into her greatness. Because when it came his turn, hello, Michelle backed him.
Yeah.
So you've got to, you being a male ally promotes you into your greatness also. It's a win-win, truly. It's a win-win. But it's not common. And things that are not common, people are scared of. People are fearful of. People tend to shy away from.
And I think that leads me into asking you about diversity in schools. I do tutoring of apprentices on the level 5 apprenticeship, doing the management and leadership apprenticeship in schools. I work with some very diverse schools and I work with other schools that are not so diverse, and it's very much dependent on obviously the area of the country that you live in. How can we promote more? We've talked a lot about women, but how can we promote more diversity in schools? Because we don't see often a reflection, even in schools where there's a very diverse school community and the pupils are so diverse. Last school I worked in was brilliant. It was multicultural, and it was, you know, all the children got on with each other. There was no segregation or anything. It was just a really lovely community to work in. But the staff did not represent, you know, the staff was not representative of that multiculturalism in the student body. So where are we in terms of that, do you think?
It's a complicated question. Sorry, the answer is complicated. Only because it's got lots and lots of parts to it.
Yeah.
There's no simple way of doing this.
It's a whole podcast on its own, really, isn't it?
It's a whole podcast on its own. So you've got, from the beginning, you're talking about recruiting into the PGC and, you know, all that kind of thing. So you're talking about promoting this as in the teaching profession, as something that you'd want to do. And frankly, sometimes the way we speak to each other on Twitter, the way the national narrative comes across from politicians and from unions and stuff, you think, why would anyone want to be a teacher?
Yeah.
Right? We're not revered. We're not, if things go well with GCSEs, oh, the exam must have been easy. Things go badly, oh, teachers are not very good. You know, the national narrative is not brilliant. So why would you want to come in? So we've got to take responsibility for some of that and change the way we speak about ourselves. Because frankly, why would I want my daughter to become a teacher? I know the value of it. So I have to work against the national narrative to get her to come. One. So that's for all people. But, you know, when you get all people talking in a positive way about something, you get a bit of a diverse pool coming through. Two, there are some areas, and we just have to accept this, there are some areas of the country that are monocultural. Just the way it is, right? You know, but you're right, there are other areas that are multicultural, you know, or more diverse. If there are diversity of children, they've got parents. What do their parents all do, right? So they're there in that community, okay? So now it's about being attractive. And just like in anything, if you want to attract talent from different pools, then you've got to make yourself attractive. You know, you're right, it's a whole podcast in itself, but there are ways that if you want to attract women into positions, there are words that you do not use in your adverts, for example. It's well documented that adverts worded in a certain way will put women off and attract men. Simple as that.
Same
for diversity. Yeah? So if you look at your application process, for example, and you are asking questions about where did you go to university? Why does it matter? What judgment are you making about? So if I went to Oxford, you're going to go, ooh, that person went to Oxford. If I went to South Bank, you know, Polytechnic, there's no, ooh, is there? Immediately, you'll set up a little bias in your mind, aren't you?
Yeah.
You start shortlisting in your mind. Well, the person that went, well, they must have done, let's just keep that one on the A pile. How many black people go to Oxford? How many black people go to South Bank University or South Bank Polytechnic as it was then? So, you know, it's just your application form, if you're not careful, will weed out talent. You don't mean to do it, but you set up this hierarchy.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So there are people who are experts in this field, helping you to bring on board the whole spectrum of diverse talent. Because we know if your teams are diverse, especially your leadership teams, it brings strategic advantage to your organization. It is a good thing.
And I suppose it's about seeking out diversity as well, isn't it? It's about understanding the nature of that. And we're not just talking about, we're talking about all different protected characteristics, you know. The more different backgrounds and culture and experiences you can have in a team, then the more you can identify, empathize with your children, with each other.
Serving, you bring about a richness and a diversity of ideas and of thought. The worst thing you can have is groupthink. Everybody has been to the same kind of university, led the same kind of life, are from the same kind of culture, and have the same kind of thoughts. Not exactly the same, but the same kind. Therefore, you get groupthink. And they all think they're right, because there's no one to say, no, that's not how we do it. Well, that's why do it that way? Simple example, in food tech, the first thing that we always learned to cook was cheese and potato pie. Hate the thing, right? Then we moved on to shepherd's pie. Hate the thing. When I my own school, I said, all right then, show me the food, you know, and it was cheese and potato pie. I mean, it hadn't changed in 30 years. And I said, I don't want that. Right? I didn't say it like that, but I basically said, I don't want that. I want to learn to cook baklava, a Turkish delicacy, to do this tagine. I want them to do, all right. Told the whole, something else than shepherd's pie, for God's sake. There's food from around the world. Apple crumble, oh, for goodness sake. Do you know what I mean? Because you just bring a diversity of thought. When the kids, I mean, the baklava they make, they brought it to me to taste, it was absolutely horrible. But they made something different. Yeah. But even in making baklava, they said a different word. They've never even used the word baklava before. They were using pistachio nuts. When do year sevens in North London use pistachio nuts?
And it's the same with the same with literature, isn't it? And art. And if you have a more diverse group of teachers who've a more broad experience of literature from other cultures, then you avoid someone branding of Mice and Men something from another culture.
So it brings advantage, because I was just doing this yesterday to some training I was doing, and it was about vocabulary in young people, and you know, young people who've got parents who are on welfare, 13 million words or something like that. The next set, parents who work in white collar jobs, was, you know, 26 million words. Parents who are professionals, 45 million words. So the vocabulary they've been exposed to.
Yeah.
Just imagine. But the thing is, with vocabulary, that underpins understanding and what you can do, what you can't do, and how big your schemata are in your brain. And so your GCSEs and all that kind of stuff. I think just introducing different words from different cultures for all the young people, why is that not a good thing? You didn't even have to plan it, you know, plan a whole lesson. All you did was change the dish from cheese and potato pie to baklava. That's all you did. You changed the dish. But you would never do that if you've got absolute groupthink.
Yeah. And that, I think, it's the whole spectrum of everything that we do, isn't it? That we need to be open to keeping the broadest of experiences possible. I'm mindful that I've been talking to you for a very long time. I know.
And wow.
It's been such a great conversation. There's so much to take from it. But the thing for me is the idea of love. At the end of the day, love, and even when we're talking about diversity, it's that idea of loving and embracing, you know, across the whole spectrum of people and experiences. And if we can bring that into schools, then I think we're in a much better position to look after staff and look after ourselves better.
I agree. I absolutely agree.
So thank you so much for coming on the show and joining us. I've absolutely loved talking to you. If people want to find you and find more about your work or find your book, where do they need to go?
So two places. So the first is courageousleadership.co.uk. That is where I do all things leadership for head teachers and for senior leaders who are in challenging circumstances. There's online courses you can take there. Me recording stuff for hours and hours on how to do this, how to do that. Just go on, subscribe, and you've got me on in your pocket then. You can also buy the book there and everything else. And then the other place is the Academy of Women's Leadership, which is awlonline.co.uk. And that's an academy that I founded that women who are leaders, you're competent, but the confidence level is not as good. You've got the CV, it's banging, but in your heart, you're still saying, does my bum look big in this? The Academy of Women's Leadership, there are 12 of us, 12 veterans of female leadership for education, somewhere in media, healthcare. And it's a place where we teach you a curriculum that will take your leadership to another level. So those are the two places where you can find me. I'm on LinkedIn a lot. So Diana Osage at LinkedIn. I'm also on Twitter, Diana_Osage.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Diane.
Welcome. It's been great talking to you.
Take care. What an amazing woman. I am sure that you enjoyed that just as much as I did, and that Diana has probably inspired you to go off and do so many things to help the staff in your school or to look after your well-being. I love that she says she's a woman who decided to live the life she wanted to live in her mind, because I find that so inspirational that she went out there and she's done what she wanted to do and she's achieved so much as a result of that. And you can feel the courage and the bravery of Diana in everything that she says, that she's had to come from a background and that she supports children from that background where the narrative was no, and how she stood up against that and showed so much bravery. I love when she talks about being a human first, because that's just chimes so much with me, that all the people we deal with are human beings. And she talks about professional love in a way that is so inspiring and makes you realise that when you challenge and support people in a way that comes from caring for them, then you can achieve so much more. I love the idea of the head surgery that she did every week, where any staff could come and talk to her. So she had that open door policy where staff felt like they could be open with her. And I love how she talks about family, love, grace and compassion as being her guiding values. And it's really important that you understand your values as a leader. And I think that's one of the things that makes Diana so successful and so authentic in her leadership, is that she is driven by her values, and that comes across in everything that she says. So make sure you know and you understand your values and how that drives what you do. Now, I want to take this opportunity to very quickly say thank you to all of the women who were on my very first Women Lead Well group coaching programme. I know a lot of them listen to the podcast and they're out there. So hi, guys. It has been absolutely amazing and a really great privilege to work with them. And I've had some amazing feedback from them about how powerful a course it's been. And I am just about to start the next cohort. So I'm going to be taking applications for that cohort support that will be starting in September. So if you are interested in that, you can find me on Facebook via the We Lead Well group. I'd love you to join us in that group. Or you can find me on Twitter, on the We Lead Well Twitter page. I'm also on LinkedIn, so you can direct message me on LinkedIn. Or you can go to the website at www.transformeducationcoach.com. I would love it if you would join us. And if you could join the Facebook group, as I've said, that would be brilliant too. Well, that's all we've got time for today. So have a great week. Take care of yourself. Take care of your staff and lead well. This episode of the We Lead Well podcast was brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchat.com and the Teach Well Alliance.